From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we remember the best-selling novelist Robertson Davies. He died Saturday at the age of 82. We listen back to an interview in which he discussed several of his preoccupations: medicine, psychology, religion, and magic. We'll also remember James Reston, who spent 50 years with the New York Times, serving as reporter, Washington bureau chief, executive editor, and columnist. He died this week at the age of 86. Book critic Maureen Carrigan discusses Irish poet Seamus Heaney, who will be awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature this weekend. And rock historian Ed Ward continues his retrospective of the Velvet Underground. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton says GOP congressional leaders will have to budge on one element of their budget plan involving Medicaid if they want to reach an agreement with the administration.
Republicans are insisting that we repeal the guarantee that no poor child, pregnant mother, poor senior citizen, or disabled person will be denied quality medical care. That would eliminate the guarantee of nursing home care for as many as 300,000 people. All told, if current patterns of coverage prevail, some 8 million people could be denied health care coverage under Medicaid, nearly half of them children. No one would want to do this in any state, but many states would have no choice under the budget now pending.
The president was speaking to a group of Democratic governors at the White House today. The budget talks between the administration and Congress resume on Monday. A man opened fire on workers and customers in a clothing store in Harlem today and then barricaded himself inside and set fire to the building. 8 people were killed and 5 injured. Police say the gunman was apparently one of the dead. The store is across the street from the famed Apollo Theater. It took more than 3 hours to put out the blaze. The nation's unemployment rate edged up to 5.6% last month. Over 150,000 new jobs were created, but Labor Secretary Robert Reich says employment in one sector of the economy continues to fall.
Manufacturing employment declined 32,000 in November. That is a potential problem. And because of that big mountain of unsold goods, inventory accumulation, probably we're not going to see any additional manufacturing growth. We may see continued erosion of manufacturing jobs in months ahead until that big mountain of unsold goods gets under control, until we see that inventory being drawn down.
Commerce Department reports new home sales were down in October for the third straight month. Talks continue today between Boeing and the union representing striking machinists. The workers have been off the job for over 2 months. Steve Kruger of member station KPLU reports.
The negotiations go into their third day with little word about movement by either side. The union did drop one of several unfair labor practice charges against the company. Those charges involve the company's refusal to hand over information about medical insurance costs. The remaining charges will be heard by a federal panel later this month. The company wants workers to pay a part of their medical insurance premiums, a suggestion the union flatly rejects. Meanwhile, charities in the Seattle area say they are suffering because of the Boeing strike. Workers who usually donate money and goods aren't contributing this year. In fact, many now are coming to the charities seeking Christmas toys and food baskets for their families. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Kruger in Seattle.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 14.5 points. In the over-the-counter market, the NASDAQ Composite is up 4.5. This is NPR. Foreign ministers and deputies from over 36 countries are meeting in London to craft an economic aid plan for Bosnia and a proposal for holding elections in the ethnically divided nation. The rebuilding work will include everything from repairing boiler rooms in Sarajevo to setting up a new central bank. The conferees are adding detail to general guidelines worked out during the Dayton peace talks. A judge in North Carolina has refused bond for 2 soldiers suspected in a pair of alleged racially motivated killings. Chris Hoskin of member station WFAE reports from Charlotte.
21-year-old James Burmeister and 20-year-old Malcolm Wright each face 2 counts of first-degree murder. They're accused of killing a black man and woman on a downtown Fayetteville street corner Wednesday night. Police say they believe the 2 were drunk when they set out to hunt down and harass blacks. Investigators say they found a Nazi flag and white supremacist pamphlets in Burmeister's room, along with a pistol that's believed to be the murder weapon. Fayetteville Police Chief Ron Hansen says there's no indication that the two are part of any organized white supremacist group. Both men are privates in the 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg. A probable cause hearing has been set for December 19th. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Hoskin in Charlotte, North Carolina.
A government mediator is talking with striking railroad workers in the third week of a crippling public employee walkout in France. The rail employees have taken the toughest line of any of the public workers. The government is hoping that a breakthrough in talks with the railroad group could be a first step toward an overall solution to the strike. The Philip Morris Company is disputing a Wall Street Journal report citing an internal draft memo that likens nicotine to cocaine and other drugs and says the main reason people smoke is to get nicotine into their bodies. A company spokesman says the memo was written by a staff member who is not a scientist, and he says the memo does not reflect the company's views on nicotine or smoking. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of our show, we remember writer Robertson Davies. He died last Saturday at the age of 82. Davies was one of Canada's most prominent writers. He grew up in small towns in Ontario, where his father published a group of newspapers. From 1942 to 62, Robertson Davies edited and published one of those papers. He's also worked as an actor and was the master of Massey College at the University of Toronto. His impressive body of work includes the novels What's Bred in the Bone, The Manticore, and Fifth Business, as well as anthologies collecting his speeches and magazine and newspaper writing. His novel The Cunning Man, which was published earlier this year, was described by several critics as one of Davies' most entertaining novels. It weaves together Davies' preoccupations with medicine, psychology, religion, and magic. I spoke to Davies in February, after it was published, and asked him about the meaning of the expression cunning man. He told me he first came across cunning men in Wales, where he used to go as a child on vacations with his father.
I discovered that there was always in every community somebody who was always called a wise woman or a cunning man. And a cunning man was somebody who was kind of, he might be a horse doctor, he might look after sick animals, he might give advice on difficult questions, he might help to find lost objects, because of course he had a sort of in on the underworld, such as it was in those districts. And also he would take spells off your animals if anybody had put a spell on them. And if you were able to manage it and talk to him tactfully, he might just put a spell on somebody else's animals for you. And this all, of course, required a fee. And that was what a cunning man was. He was a kind of village wizard.
Did you ever go to see a cunning man?
Oh, I saw several of them, yes.
And did you ask them to do anything for you?
No, I didn't dare to. I just talked to them and was interested in them, and they were not very communicative to me because, you see, I seemed to them to be a very young fellow from a far-off country, and so they were a little watchful of me.
Were you a believer or a skeptic?
Oh, a believer.
Now, the main character in your novel, The Cunning Man, is a doctor. Do you see him as a cunning man?
Well, that's what people called him, because he had something of the same attitude toward his work. And although he was a properly trained and indeed very highly trained medical doctor, he did certain things which were not strictly orthodox medicine, and consequently people sometimes playfully and sometimes rather sneeringly called him the cunning man because, you know, he was dealing in things which weren't strictly orthodox medicine.
There's a brief passage I'd like you to read from The Cunning Man about how this doctor sees himself as a doctor, his approach to practicing medicine.
I believe, as I discovered Paracelsus had believed before me, that there are as many stomachs, hearts, livers, and lights as there are members of the human race, and that they should be treated individually to suit their special needs, whatever these might be. And those needs are not always to be found in the laboratory, but in the lay confessional of the physician's consulting room. Treatment must be intensely personal. And if sometimes it strays into the realm of mind, there the physician must follow it. But usually it is in that realm where mind and body mingle, where the mind affects the body and the body the mind, and where untangling the relationship is the devil's own work and takes time and application and sympathy, that the hard-driven general practitioner and his specialist brother cannot be expected to provide for every patient who knocks on his door. I suppose if I were driven to describe my method of work, I would call it a type of psychosomatic medicine by which I attempted to bring about change in the disease syndromes through language and therefore through reason. And sometimes, and this is where the canker gnawed for many of my ultra-reasonable colleagues, in that fibrous darkness below reason, the change might never be complete, but the patient would feel much better because he, perhaps more often she, had learned to approach the individual quality of life and the body through which life was experienced in a different way. No, not psychoanalysis. That marvelous but extremely limited adventure in human understanding behaves as if its patients lived principally in the mind, and as if the patient's coughs and colds and indigestions, arthritis, bad lower back, tricky heart, asthma, skin ailments, and all the rest of their disquiets were creatures of another realm to be dealt with by somebody else.
That's Robertson Davies reading from his new novel, The Cunning Man, and I think that our listeners won't be surprised to hear that at one time in your career you were an actor. You read that really well.
Thank you.
Well, is this your idea of what a doctor should be?
It's an idea, my idea of what an ideal doctor might be, and I've only known one or two who came anywhere near the mark. Because, you see, it is so extraordinarily expensive if you're going to spend 2 hours with a patient instead of 10 minutes. And most doctors can't afford that sort of thing.
Now, why are you particularly interested in doctors?
Well, I suppose everybody's interested in doctors, but I'm interested in an enormous variety of things, and I've always been interested in professional attitudes, lawyers, doctors, clergymen, all that sort of person. And it seems to me that doctors very often are chained by a rather rigid professional attitude, which rules out a number of things which you might like them to pay attention to if they were doctoring you.
Such as?
Well, your state of mind, your feelings about life, your feelings about what life had brought to you and what you had brought to life. Because I think that these lie at the root of an awful lot of trouble, which manifests itself sometimes in ill health of one kind and another. I think, you know, that Thoreau was right when he said that an extraordinary number of people lived lives that were crippled by despair. And a great many people, really deep in their hearts, are rather despairing. They feel that life hasn't done right by them, that they've somehow or other had a raw deal. And although on the surface they may seem to be fortunate, deep down they feel that something is wanting. And they crave that thing, whatever it may be, passionately. And if the craving is not fulfilled, it might manifest itself in a disease of some kind.
Now, are you speaking of yourself at all here, or just about other people?
Oh, me and everybody else, yes.
Have you had a lot of reason to see doctors over the years? Have you had health problems?
Oh, yes, I have. And some of them were rather annoying, and some of them were farcical, and some of them were extremely disagreeable.
Would you mention any?
Yes, certainly. I wouldn't mind. I was telling that when I was about 35... I became rather unwell. I had shortness of breath and felt under the weather and generally not very good. And so I went to see my doctor, thinking that I just probably needed a tonic or something. But he was a very modern doctor with all the latest sort of ideas. And he x-rayed me a lot and discovered that I had some things inside me which he didn't like the look of. And he decided that I had a very ugly form of cancer, Hodgkin's disease. It's cancer of the lymphatic system. And he sent me to a specialist, and the specialist nodded his head and said, yes, oh, indeed, that's what it is. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, well, it's not very good. And I said, is it fatal? He said, well, yes, it can be. I said, how soon? Well, he said it could be a few months. Or, you know, we've got patients we've kept going for 17 years. And I thought, oh, thank you very much. What fun to be kept going for 17 years. And I was very, very bothered by this. And they gave me very extensive ray treatment for it, because in those days, heavy ray treatment was all the thing.
This was 46 years ago.
Yes, and I felt like a whipped dog for about 18 months. And then, you know, I didn't show any further symptoms. I seemed to be all right, contrary to all medical decency. And they had the bare face to say, well, it must have been a misdiagnosis.
Do you think they really misdiagnosed you, or do you think you just made one of those unusual recoveries?
Well, now there, I cannot tell you, but you see, I'll tell you something. When I was told that I had this dreadful thing and that it was a killer, I thought, this is utterly out of the question. I cannot afford to die. I have a wife and two small children. I have people dependent on me. It's just not on the books that I could die. I haven't the time or the... I haven't got what it takes to do that. I've got to keep going. And I did. But whether that was a recovery because of something that I thought or because of the doctors having made a mistake, I don't know. But they never admitted they'd made a mistake till long after I had finished that wretched treatment.
The doctor in your novel was, as you put it, severely bitten by the bug of psychoanalysis and read everything he could find out about it. For several years, he was under its spell. And that's Freudian psychoanalysis.
Yes.
Early on. Were you ever under the spell of Freudian analysis?
Oh, yes, indeed I was. You see, when I first went to the university, we had a marvelous professor of psychology who introduced his students to Freudian ideas, and they were intensely interesting, and they're very, very interesting to young people, because they seem to explain everything, and they explain everything in a rather gloomy, downbeat way, and young people love gloom, because they can afford gloom. They're young enough and healthy enough to be able to put up with that attitude toward life. But as I grew older, I didn't become disillusioned with Dr. Freud's ideas, but I began to have my own reservations about them, particularly about his notions of sex being, vital to virtually every human thing. And so I rather got over Freud and began to be deeply interested in C.G. Jung, whom I found a much more humanistic and, for a writer, a much more literary person in his consideration of the human spirit.
Well, how do you think Jung influenced you as a writer?
Oh, enormously, because I know this sounds incredibly pompous and grandiose, but I found that Jung confirmed a lot of things which I had thought myself, but which I hadn't got any sort of care, medical or scientific backing for. And so I was perfectly delighted with him and went on and followed his reading with the keenest interest for years and years and years, and indeed do so still.
We're featuring an interview from earlier this year with Robertson Davies. He died last Saturday at the age of 82. We'll hear more of this interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with our interview with writer Robertson Davies. Now, as a young man, after college, I suppose, you went to England and had a brief career there as an actor. What drew you to acting, and why did you leave the profession?
Well, I loved acting, and I wanted to be an actor, and would probably have been one, except that the 1939 war broke out, and immediately a rule was made, or a law was passed in England, where I was working, that all theatres were to be closed because there were to be no places where large numbers of people were to assemble because of bombing. And so I woke up one morning, and in London there were about 5,000 people, 5,000 actors out of work, and I think I was number 4999. And so I had to get a living somehow or other, and so I turned back to the family trade, which is journalism.
So you went back to Canada?
Yes.
And started writing?
Yes, you see, in England they didn't want people around who didn't have to be there. And so I got out and went back to Canada and was able to get a job in journalism, and did.
Now, you've said that you don't think you started writing important fiction until after your parents were dead because you were too inhibited. There were things you couldn't say while they were alive. What were your fears about how your writing could have affected your parents?
Well, it would have embarrassed them in some ways, I think. Because of my attitudes towards a great many things, including sex. And so I didn't want to distress them, and I didn't write about that kind of thing in the way that I eventually did until after they were no longer there.
Did you ever feel that, well, your writing was important enough to justify any discomfort that it caused your parents?
No. I had the greatest respect for my parents and didn't wish to give them pain. And I wouldn't have done it, and I didn't do it, and I knew that I could just wait, and then the time would come.
We actually waited a long time. Your father lived to be 95.
No, he didn't live to be 95.
He didn't?
Lived to be 87.
Oh, 87. I'm sorry. I don't know where I read that.
Well, I know it spread around a lot as though he had lived to be like Methuselah, but he didn't.
So
he was a mere lad of 87 when he died.
Uh-huh. So how did your writing change after that?
I wrote with much greater freedom and was able to say what I thought and why I thought it and how I thought it.
Robertson Davies is my guest. I want to quote something that you've said about a Jungian viewpoint. This is one of the lectures that you delivered. And you wrote, Jungians say that in the first part of a life, it's man's chief aim to be personal and social. Find your work. Find out what kind of sex life you will lead, achieve some place in the world. Then after you've achieved those ends, your attention turns to matters that are broader in scope and often more disturbing to contemplate. Physical strength is waning, and you realize someday you're going to die, and that the way you approach death has some importance to you. This change doesn't make you an old man. What would is a frightened clinging to the values of the first part of your life. Do you feel that you went through this type of change?
Oh, very decidedly, yes.
Can you put your finger on when it was?
Oh, when I was about 40 to 45, that sort of thing.
What changed?
Well, what changed is exactly what I talked about in what you were quoting. I had found my profession. I had found my place in it, what I had to do, what my responsibilities were. I was married, I had a home, and I had children to take care of. All that sort of thing was in order and was capable of being dealt with, you see. But then I had other things, personal things to deal with, of a deeply personal kind, religious attitudes, attitudes towards the broader and more important aspects of life, all that sort of thing. And I had to come to terms with those and make up my mind about them.
Well, you write in the quote, what would make you an old man is a frightened clinging to the values of the first part of your life. Was it hard to change? Was it hard to give up certain values?
No, not for me. But I know for many people it is. Many men particularly, and I suppose it's the same for women, but I can't pretend to speak for them, but many men cling to youthful strength, youthful physical ability, youthful attitude towards sex, trying to make themselves attractive to women, all that sort of thing that young men do, and sort of aggressive and perhaps slightly boastful attitude toward life.
How many years have you been married?
Let me see, 55.
It's a long time.
Yes, it's a good while.
And from your writing, I mean, it really seems to me that you think that marriage for you has really been just central to every part of your life, including writing.
That is true. I don't think that's necessarily so for everybody. I've been lucky. It has been true for me.
What's the next project you plan on taking on?
Oh, I am writing all the time. I'm very busy at that sort of thing. And I expect I shall be like Bernard Shaw and be writing when I'm an old man.
Are you starting another novel?
I may do so before too long. I haven't started one yet. I'm making notes.
So you're not sure what the next book will be?
Oh, no, and I wouldn't tell you if I did.
It's no good to talk about it while it's happening?
No, it's very unlucky.
Okay.
And I'm intensely superstitious. That's one of the things I include under religion.
Superstition?
Yes.
What's the connection?
Well, obviously, it's omens and foreseeings and that sort of thing. I feel that these things all have a place in religion. I get awfully tired of people who want to exclude all that sort of thing and brush it aside as though it were unworthy of a decent mind. You've got to have a place in your mind for all sorts of irrationalities if you're going to get your ideas straight about life.
What else are you superstitious about?
Omens, things, so forth. One of the most intelligent men I ever knew was a scientist. When he went out of his house in the morning, he lived in Italy. If he saw a nun or a priest passing his doorstep, he went back inside his house and stayed there for the rest of the day because that meant it was an unlucky day. And this was a man who spent his life doing scientific experiment.
Would you ever do that?
Well, not perhaps as determinedly as that, but I keep a watchful eye out for things that might just not be good, you know.
What are those things? What are the bad
omens? I couldn't tell you right now, but perhaps when I step out of the studio, I'll meet something that I don't know what it might be.
Well, keep a watchful eye.
I will, yes.
Robertson Davies, it's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you very much indeed. Robertson Davies recorded earlier this year after the publication of his novel, The Cunning Man. Davies died last weekend at the age of 82. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember James Reston, the former executive editor and columnist at the New York Times. He died this week at the age of 86. Also, Maureen Corrigan discusses poet Seamus Heaney, who will receive the Nobel Prize for Literature this weekend. And rock critic Ed Ward continues his retrospective of the Velvet Underground. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On Sunday, Irish poet Seamus Heaney will be awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature at a ceremony in Stockholm, Sweden. Book critic Maureen Corrigan shares some recollections of her brush with greatness.
The day the Nobel Prizes were announced in early October, my phone rang and I heard a voice I hadn't heard in years. It was that of an old college friend, and her abrupt greeting went like this. "Maureen, it's Pat. Isn't it wonderful?" I knew instantly what she meant, and I also knew how she'd spent the earlier part of that day. Like me, she had probably opened some well-thumbed volumes of poetry and reread the most memorable verses, those with titles like Bog Queen, Fieldwork, and Station Island. Then she no doubt turned to the first page of each volume and read the inscriptions. In my edition of North, there's a cryptic one that reads, "For Maureen, Dance the Dance, Seamus, August 1975. The future Seamus Heaney scholar who reads those lines long after I'm gone will be stumped. But to me, they bring back memories of a raucous summer night in the courtyard of an Irish pub after a poetry reading. A bunch of poets and poetry lovers were whirling around, dancing, I think, to the music of Van Morrison. And at one point, Seamus Heaney rescued me from the gropings of a whiskey-soaked, lesser Irish poet. I was a starry-eyed young thing who believed the only thoughts poets had on their minds were about art and beauty. That was a long time ago. Pat and I were in Ireland that summer with a couple of college classmates because of a wonderful English professor who invited us to come over with her and study Yeats. We traveled all around the country, but wherever we went, Seamus Heaney kept turning up. Because my professor and he were friends, we ate dinners and closed pubs together. With the blaséness of youth, we students all called him Seamus and peppered him with legitimate but unsophisticated questions like, "How do you know when you've ended a poem?" and "Do you ever run out of ideas?" He answered every question with good humor and took all of us students seriously. I didn't learn until much later on, when I began teaching myself, how hard that can be to do. That extraordinary summer, which passed for me in a golden haze of Guinness and poetry, marked a turning point in Heaney's life as well. A Catholic from Northern Ireland, he had recently moved with his family to Dublin, and the poetry he wrote through the 1970s and beyond became increasingly political, as though distance from the violence freed his voice. Even in his political poems, however, Heaney has never lost his trademark visceralness. When he writes about the sound of an all-night drubbing rain or the earthy stench of bogs, you're there. In a just-published collection of essays entitled The Redress of Poetry, Heaney talks a lot about how poetry can and does change the world. "The world is different," he says, "after it has been read by a Shakespeare or an Emily Dickinson or a Samuel Beckett, because it has been augmented by their reading of it." Lots of his readers would add Heaney's own name to that illustrious list. At least on this occasion, the Nobel Academy has acknowledged genuine greatness, bestowing its honor on a writer whose capacious vision and precisely beautiful language rivals any English language poet of the 20th century. After the summer of 75, the only times I've seen Heaney have been from afar, at monster poetry readings in large auditoriums. He wouldn't remember me, but I'll never forget his kindness. I know it's dangerous to generalize about a person's character from one summer. For all I know, Heaney could nurse a secret predilection for skinning cats, but I don't think so. As far as my old friend Pat and I are concerned, the Nobel Prize couldn't be awarded to a nicer guy.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Coming up, we remember journalist James Reston, who spent 50 years at the New York Times. He died this week at the age of 86. This is Fresh Air. The front page of today's New York Times carries the obituary of a journalist who gave 50 years of his life to the paper, James Reston. Reston died of cancer Wednesday at the age of 86. The Times obit describes Reston as perhaps the most influential journalist of his generation. He hired and trained many of the Times' best-known writers and served as mentor to many more. Reston started at the Times as a reporter and went on to work as Washington bureau chief, executive editor, and columnist. He retired in 1989 on his 80th birthday. Reston was known to his friends as Scotty, a nickname that he got because he was born in Scotland. I spoke with him in 1991 after the publication of his memoir, Deadline. He started his journalism career as a sports writer for the Associated Press. Now it may seem unusual to go from sports writer to foreign correspondent, but he told me it wasn't so unusual then.
Sports were an addiction in the 20s and 30s, even more so than they are today. That was the days of Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Bill Tilden in tennis and Bobby Jones in golf. And the sports writers were rather models for young kids like myself in the Middle West because we were caught up in this sports thing. And when I look back on it, I have two thoughts. One... It's a wonderful way to begin for a very simple reason, that the audience for sports knows much more about what is being reported than, for example, the audience of politics. If you make a mistake in sports writing, you get a punch in the nose. If you make a mistake in political writing, you get a letter to the editor. There is a great difference between the two for a young guy trying to learn accuracy.
Which was the more compelling reason to be accurate, the punch in the nose or the letter to the editor?
Always a punch in the nose. Right. Always a punch in the nose, sure.
Well, you were in England writing about sports when England went to war with Germany, and the New York Times called you and said, look, we need someone in a real hurry to cover the war, and they signed you up. You, of course, had wanted to work for the Times already. Did you feel prepared to make that transition from sports to war?
No, I didn't. You see, that is one of the interesting great differences between my generation and the present generation. We were, the young characters getting out of college in the early 30s during the Depression, before the United States was involved in the world, we were really, truly isolated. We didn't know the languages of the world. I didn't know the difference between the Baltic states and the Balkans. So there was a great, we were not prepared. But, you know, the interesting things about that particular period was that we didn't know we weren't prepared. It was, this was in the days before psychiatrists took over and said, have you found yourself? We didn't even know we were lost. We were that dumb.
You say that when you were Washington bureau chief during the McCarthy years, that McCarthy took advantage of the cult of objectivity. How did he do that?
Well, he did that in a very very cunning and clever way. You see, in those days, you have to realize that in a great diverse country like this, newspapers all over the country could not afford to send correspondents to Washington, let alone to all the capitals of the world. Therefore, they had to rely on the Associated Press and the United Press, and in those days, in the International News Service. These were cooperative news-gathering organizations. But they represented papers of much different political persuasions. And therefore, their tendency was, indeed their rule was, that they put out the news, whatever was said, without comment, without interpretation. Joe McCarthy understood that very well and realized that whatever a senator said, provided he put his name to it, the agencies would carry what he had to say, and he took advantage of that. So that when he said that there were 87 communists in the State Department, the agencies, the news agencies, carried that story. And then when he was challenged, he said, no, he was wrong about that. There were 105 agencies. So they carried that, too. And that gave him a tremendous opportunity to corrupt the whole idea of being fair and objective.
So, in other words, McCarthy felt that he could make any charge he wanted to, and it would get in print
exactly.
without a reporter trying to investigate whether that charge was true or
not. Exactly.
Do you feel you ever fell for that yourself? Were you able to get around that?
Well, of course. We all fell for it for a while, but eventually we caught up with it.
When you were the executive editor, were there changes you tried to make in the writing and reporting style of the reporters who worked with you?
Well, at that particular point, there was a very interesting problem in the newspapers. The radio had come along and had taken from the newspaper the job of being the first reporter of the news. You're too young to remember the days when I broke in and there was a great story. It was the newspapers that the people relied on it. And little boys ran through the streets at night shouting, extra, extra. That haunting call ended with the radio, because the radio could come in much quicker than we could with the news. Therefore, we had to find a new role, and that new role was to try to explain the causes and consequences of the news. And that was, sometimes we complained about the radio, but the radio did the newspapers a great favor, because we should have been dealing with the causes and consequences long before we had the crisis.
How did you like being executive editor at the Times?
I did not like it because I didn't think I was very good at it.
Why not? What does it take to be good that you weren't?
Well, I didn't want to do it, and second, I wanted to write. I was a writer, beginning and end, and that was where I was happy, and I tried to be both an editor and a columnist, and ended up by being not fair to either one.
You retired on your 80th birthday. Was that your plan, to do it on your birthday, make it really symbolic?
No, it just seemed a sensible thing to do. You know, as an old sports writer, I know when pitchers begin to lose the hop on their fastball and when people get tired of them. And so I thought I ought to get out while I was ahead.
James Reston, recorded in 1991. He died earlier this week at the age of 86. On Tuesday, one of America's greatest singers ever, Frank Sinatra, turns 80. We'll join in the celebration then by talking to Nancy Sinatra, his daughter, Billy May, one of his arrangers, and Matt Dennis, who wrote some of the songs Sinatra has recorded, like Angel Eyes and Let's Get Away From It All. In fact, why don't we listen to one of Sinatra's records now? This is an outtake of one of the many songs Sinatra owns, One for My Baby. This version was a practice duet with his pianist Bill Miller that was intended to be erased, but it ended up lost in the vaults of Capitol Records for 32 years. Luckily, it was found and was reissued in 1990 by Capitol.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe. I got a little story you ought to know. We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a brief episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road. I got the routine, put another nickel in the machine. Feeling so bad, can't you make the music easy and sad? I could tell you a lot, but you gotta be true to your code. Make it one for my baby, one more for the road. You'd never know it, but buddy, I'm a kind of poet, and I got a lot of things I'd like to say. And when I'm gloomy, won't you listen to me till it's talked away? Well, that's how it goes.
Enjoy. We'll hear more music by Sinatra on Tuesday when we celebrate his 80th birthday. This is Fresh Air. When the Velvet Underground performed from 1965 to 70, they hardly sold any records. Their dark sensibility and discordant music was not appreciated by the hippie culture of the time. But now the Velvets are considered one of the most important bands of the 60s. A new CD box set collects their recordings. It inspired our rock historian Ed Ward to do a two-part retrospective of the band. When Ed left off yesterday, the Velvets had separated from Andy Warhol, their first manager, and tension within the band was at a high point. At a time when many other bands might have given up, the Velvets managed not only to keep going, but to produce the music on which the larger part of their legacy lies.
She's over by the corner, got her hands by her side.
'68 shouldn't have been a good year for the Velvet Underground. Separated from their mentor Andy Warhol, with two poorly selling albums behind them, they were hated by rock impresario Bill Graham and banned from his Fillmore halls on both coasts. And as for getting played even on the emerging freeform radio stations, forget it. They toured, since they were somewhat popular in places like Boston, Cleveland, and Texas, but a rift was growing between Lou Reed and John Cale. In September, Reed asked Cale to leave, and he did. a mysterious youngster named Doug Yule was added on bass, and the band flew to California to record its third album. On the way, something crucial happened. Their gear was stolen at Kennedy Airport. All the gizmos and boxes that had made their second album such a noise fest were gone. Armed only with straight guitars and a bunch of great Lou Reed songs, they hunkered down. The results were spectacular.
Candy said, I've come to hate my body and all that it requires in this world. Candy said,
reporting the lives of his characters, Reed had gotten inside them, as with Candy Says, written about Warhol superstar transsexual Candy Darling. His melodic gift came to the fore, too.
Sometimes I feel so happy. Sometimes I feel so sad. Sometimes I feel so happy. But mostly you just make me mad. Baby, you just make me mad. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Linger on your pale blue eyes.
But their power and their ability to play with sound hadn't left them. On the record, simply entitled The Velvet Underground, What Goes On features, at its close, one of the most remarkable moments ever recorded. The band seems to have found the resonant frequency of the room and turned it into an instrument that lingers behind the chord changes. Beginning to see the light threatens to careen out of control, and Reed keeps it together until the very last couplet, where he declares, "There are troubles in these times, who, but none of them are mine." And there's the pensive "I'm set free," whose words, "I'm set free to find a new illusion," should have been heard by more counterculturists. Even the painfully shy Maureen Tucker comes out from behind the drums to sing a song. What's just as remarkable as what was released on this album is what wasn't. The much bootlegged Foggy Notion became an underground classic, and there were two more Says songs, Stephanie Says and Lisa Says.
Lisa says that it's all right when she meets me alone at night. Lisa says that she has her fun and she'll do it with
there was the spunky I Can't Stand It. But the Velvets were ending. Maureen got pregnant and left, to be replaced by Doug Yule's brother Billy. Mike Curb, the new conservative head of MGM Records, for which they'd recorded, dropped them in a moral purge. One last album was made for Atlantic, on which it was evident that they had turned into the Lou Reed Band.
Standing on the corner, suitcase in my hand. Jackson's corset, Jane is in her vest. And me, I'm in a rock and roll band. Huh. Riding a Stutz Bearcat, Jim. You know, those were different times. All the poets, they studied rules of verse. And those ladies, they rolled their eyes.
It didn't matter. The legend had been established. In the Prague spring of 1968, students heard the Velvet Underground and made a connection. In Detroit, the noise experiments were duly noted and added to the local rock vocabulary. And the records would sell long after Sterling Morrison had gone to pursue a PhD and Reed became a superstar. A decade later, as punk rose from the streets, their role as visionaries was finally confirmed. This two-part series is in memory of Sterling Morrison, who died earlier in 1995.
Ed Ward is a writer based in Berlin. The new Velvet Underground box set is on PolyGram Records. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Sapora Lubar. Our program is directed by Roberta Shurrock. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And from Sense and Sensibility, from the Jane Austen novel, at select theaters Wednesday. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.